Coming up next on Futures in Biotech, we bring back all the co-hosts, panelists, and subject matter experts for touchy-feely, warm and fuzzy, feel-good farewell.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 95. So long, and thanks for all the fibs.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history.
DNA is the code for life.
We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
All right. Well, welcome to Futures in Biotech. This is going to be a very special episode. It is the last episode of Futures in Biotech on TWiT TV. So it's the TWiT Fib finale. And, you know, TWiT has been on for many years. This is its sixth year. And we've built somewhat of an archive of shows that covers some of the best scientists that we could ever speak to. I think there was four Nobel laureates, including Oliver Smithies and Mario Capecchi, Kandel, Chalfie, Apollo astronauts, Buzz Aldrin, Harrison Schmitt, who was on Apollo 17 with 20 hours of extra vehicular activity on the moon. It's been an incredible honor to do this show and to do it on the TWiT network. And importantly, the show is going to continue. So for listeners that are fans, if you are out there, we're going to continue doing science firsthand accounts and exploring the world of science from a perspective whereby we are the subject matter for engineering, because life is a substrate for engineering now, and this is the sort of the century of biotech. So, but one of the things I wanted to do in the last show is bring back all the people that have been either panelist or guest host. And so we're going to do a record here of a number of people on a TWiT episode, an episode of on TWiT TV. And I brought on, was it seven PhDs?
Eight PhDs.
Eight PhDs and two non-PhDs. So we're 10 people here on the show. And so let me go down the line and introduce folks. I'll start off video-wise instead. Why don't we do that instead of order? We've got Jason Buch.
Hello.
He's he's an aromics employee and the head of our data analysis. We've got George Farr, Dr. George Farr.
Hi, everybody.
He's a vice president at aromics. Let's not wave our hands too much. Skype is feeble. We've got Josh Detzel, who's a student at the University of Ohio.
Just wait.
And one of our summer students.
At the Ohio State University.
Yeah, yes. Ohio State University, sure. Great school.
Well, when you see the football players, it's the.
Well, we got their most talented students. So yes. Next we have Mark Griswold, who's a Case Western Reserve University full professor as of July 1st. Congratulations.
Thanks, Mark. Hey, everybody.
He's an MRI specialist and might be able to explain what's going on with that Higgs boson, because none of us can. All right, let's switch over to Montreal, Canada, or Quebec.
Quebec.
We have a little bit of an echo.
Is this working? Dave Thomas from biochemistry at McGill University.
And I'm Andre Nantel from the NRC in McGill University.
All right. And by the way, I have to preface this. Dave was my PhD mentor. And if anybody can take it away, he can. So, yeah.
So be good.
I got to be good on my story because we're going to talk about best and worst days in the lab. And maybe my worst day was one in a day in his lab. But it was a good day. It was a good but tough day. All right. Next, let's go over to Dr. Dave Broadbeck, Chair of Psychology at Algoma University in Sault Ste. Marie.
Guys, in the words of Dr. Yukio Hattori, on the Japanese game show Iron Chef, always a pleasure.
truly a professor. And now we have Justin Sanchez at the University of is Miami? Is it University
Miami.
Of Florida?
Yeah. Who wants to come down and go to the beach?
I'm there, but it's already 100 degrees here.
Yeah, it's 34 Celsius here right now, man. It's hot enough.
By the way, Justin was not only a guest host, panelist, but he was also has been a guest. So has Mark Griswold and Dave Thomas, and and Vincent Ragnialo too. Has Vincent been a guest? Vincent, we got Vincent Ragnialo.
I've been a guest on show number
guest
5, Mark,
and co-host. Yeah, I've done it. Just think, this is the 13th appearance, Mark, on your show. So thanks very much.
Well, I'd like to let everybody know that Vincent is my new boss. So we're taking the show to join him on his science network called Microbe TV. And Vincent, over the past few years, has built up a beautiful network of science shows that are extremely compelling. While they are somewhat focused in virology, parasitology, and microbiology, they tend to cover those fields in a way that, you know, bring in their impacts in society. So it's kind of a broad-reaching science show, regardless of the sort of title that's somewhat focused in nature. So he's done such a great job. When I got the news from Twit and called him up and said, hey, boy, it'd be fun to be with you guys, because it's very focused. And if you notice on iTunes, people who listen to Fib also listen to TWIV. People who listen to TWIV also listen to Fib. Highly related. So welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thanks very much. The only thing, Mark, is you should have had every guest you ever had on the show today. That would have been good.
Yeah, there's probably about 70. We even had the chief engineer of the command module, the guy who designed the ship that went to the moon. Tremendous fellow. His name is Mike Vucelic. Tremendous fellow. He was the guy who produced that list for CRANS and help save the lives of the crew of Apollo 13. It's been so much fun. But I think we're going to be able to continue bringing in, fortunately, because of TWIT, I've been able to build up a list of interviewees that will help me bridge that gap and continue pulling in those great guests. I think it'll be fun. So we're going to plug microbe.tv. So this will be the drinking game. Everybody can... Every time we say microbe.tv, they can take a sip, and we're going to be saying it a lot today. So let's go down the topics. I think one of the goals was to have some fun here on the last show, and one of the things I wanted to do is talk about the worst day in the lab, the best day in the lab, the best talk somebody has seen, their favorite scientist and why, what are the most important achievements in biotech, and so forth. So we're going to go down a list of topics here. And science is, it's like a road, and that road is a bumpy road. And there's a lot of hard work, very little pay. And why do we do it, right? Well, it's because those days that things work, it can be extremely exhilarating and sort of, because you're on the frontier, you're on the cutting edge. That being said, let's go down the line and tell our story about the worst day in the lab. Who should I start with? How about Mark? Mark Griswold. Do you have a worst day?
I have many worst days. I mean, I think if I count the days when I'm dealing with something that's not science, like administration or regulation or something like that, those are worst days. I can tell my magnificent worst day story, though. I was in between undergraduate and graduate school, and I was going to be doing my PhD, hopefully on a huge MRI scanner under the guy who invented MRI, Paul Lauterbur. This was a scanner that was about 30 feet in diameter, weighed 140 tons and was in the basement of this huge building. And essentially because of a, to make a long story short, the 15 of us who were working on it were sitting around having a meeting and something went haywire and the magnet blew itself up in a very dramatic fashion. Turned 1,500 liters of liquid helium into gas, which would have been enough to fill a football stadium. And yeah, the whole thing, 130 tons, basically imploded on itself inside the magnet, and $10 million project gone. So that's kind of a bad day. On the other hand, it was a good day. It forced me to leave that institution. I went to Boston, met my wife, got on a new project, and
Wait a minute, it forced you to leave. Wow, the accident was, well, I guess, was it because the equipment was no longer available?
Yeah, it was gone. The whole project folded. $10 million project folded. It's kind of a bad day.
Right.
Okay. Everybody was speaking with high, squeaky voices.
So the funny thing was that this was so loud. I mean, this was so spectacular. You know, it's like a rocket launch, essentially, and you're standing right next to it. And so your first instinct is to run.
Oh.
And my job was, if there was any problem like this, and we imagined it on a much smaller scale than this, my job was to go find the oxygen sensor and make sure that everybody was going to be all right. But I was, I don't know, 50 yards on the other side of the oxygen sensor by the time I realized that, oh, wait a minute, I got to go run back in.
I want to point out that these difficult stories are somewhat for the other scientists that are aspiring scientists in graduate school and so forth. What seems like it's the end of the world, it isn't the end of the world, and you can actually get through it. And sometimes laugh about it. So Mark was just telling us that his MRI had exploded.
Yeah, the only way that you can get through this is to laugh about it. So, so literally the place is chaos. There's an explosion that's happened. There's people throwing computers from 30 feet up high, trying to save them from the liquid air that's raining down from all over the room. And at that moment, the pizza guy shows up with our dinner.
At least he didn't go hungry.
And so we didn't go hungry. So we all sat in a room about this size. There was 15 of us. And it was just quiet. And Paul Lauterbur, the guy who invented MRI, said, "So what happened?" And Doug Morris, one of my other friends, said, "The magnet blew up, Paul. It's probably dead." And that was the end of my career there. So 15 of us were there, roughly, and within 3 months, everybody except for three people were gone. I was one of the last ones to be a part of the kind of engineering team. And then, I went to Boston.
Your PhD?
No.
Or master's?
No, just to work.
Okay, just to work.
Just to work.
And they looked at your CV and said, "Oh yeah, you're the." you're the guy that blew up.
No.
You were there when it blew up. You were part of the team that blew up in MRI.
Kind of, but I essentially inherited my own lab because somebody else had left, and so I had my own lab space, my own equipment, and set up my own group essentially as like an assistant professor, but I didn't have a PhD. This was at one of the Harvard medical schools. Met my wife.
Close one door, open the other.
Exactly. Met my wife there, and we had we came upon this new kind of imaging, new kind of MRI while I was there with another colleague who I would not have met at another institution, and launched everything from there. So yeah, it was the worst day, but it ended up being
just another day.
It was a great day in the end.
Good thing helium's not flammable too, right?
Yeah, it was. There's lots of fun stories about that day.
Hey, why don't we go to Dave Thomas, and then we'll move to Vincent after that, because you know, Vincent's a virologist, and that's a scary scenario.
Yeah, I wanted to make a joke, Mark, about the best day and the worst day, but and make it very personalized. But I thought not. So I've never had a bad day in the lab. I've always,
because it's especially, never in the lab.
So far, yeah. I do remember one night in the lab, and I was working late one night, as they say, and opening the door and seeing water flowing down the corridor, and the guard of the building coming up, and we kind of mopped it all up, and there were a few kind of vents in the side of the corridor, so I pushed some of the water down there. We mopped up the rest. Coming in the next day and getting a call from a guy who was two floors below, a Nobel Prize winner, Gerhard Hertzberg, who is the astrophysics group, and going down to see him, and I've never seen, and going into his office, and which was two floors below my lab, and nothing was wrong, and he's jumping up and down. He was kind of a short guy and a very distinguished guy, and I was not about to listen too much to what he was saying because his office looked perfect. And then he went up to Physical Reviews in his bookcase. And what had happened was the water came down behind the bookcase, and all the issues had expanded. So he would put his hand up and jump up and down and try and tear one out, and just the back would come off. And I laughed, which enraged him even more. And anyway, that there were repercussions to that, which were... I would not say were deleterious to my career, but certainly I will not get a Nobel Prize for astrophysics. that was a kind of a strange evening in the lab. And good days, there's a good day every day. And if today isn't good, tomorrow will be. We're eternal optimists. If you're a scientist, today is bad, yesterday was awful, but tomorrow is going to be really great.
I've known you for what, almost 20 years, and now I understand why you switched from physics to biology.
Excellent.
That explains it. Endorphins. You have endogenous endorphins, and you're up or you're down. I'm always up, at least for science. Yeah.
Let's go to Andre, because he's on camera right now. So.
Okay. Well, I mean, usually the bad days is always the worst ones, is when you hear you don't get a grant, and you have to tell the people in your lab that you have to let him go. For me, that has always been the worst situation in my career. But the one I want to tell is a bad day, but hopefully is also pretty funny. And that was when I was a graduate student at University of North Carolina, and I was a TA in a molecular and developmental biology lab. And what we had to do for preparing for this lab is I was a lab on embryonic development, and model then was sea urchins. And what we had to do essentially is me and the other TA, we had to go and pick up the sea urchins at the Raleigh-Durham airport, which was about 45 minutes away. Little details, we have to pick them up at 2 a.m. in the morning. So we get up, we go pick them up at the cargo sections at RDU at 2 a.m. in the morning, drive them back to UNC, get into the cold room. And because this is a lab that doesn't last all day, and you want the students to see all of the different embryonic developmental phase, you have to start fertilizing the sea urchin at, like, by then it was like 3:30, 4 a.m. in the morning, and do this until the lab started at about 1 in the afternoon so that they'd see various stages of development. Well, the way you do that is you have to get sperm and eggs from the sea urchin. So essentially you have to get them, you're in the cold room, you have to give them an electrical shock with little electrodes. And we had a lot of sea urchin. And the problem was that there was a storm in the coast of Oregon where they came from. So the female sea urchin, you would electrocute them, and they would come out pink. And then, okay, you get ova. You keep doing, you try to find males. We couldn't find males. And when we tried to find males, nothing would come out. And I think we must have masturbated 50 urchins over the next 3 hours in a cold room. We got two males.
Wow.
And the sperm was bad. So the whole lab was an abject failure. And the worst story of it is because it was a failure, we knew that the next week we had to go through this all over again. So,
yeah. That's kind of weird in many levels there, Andre.
Room masturbating turns with the electricity. That is probably the worst days I've ever spent in the lab, and that's why I'm not in developmental biology.
Let's take it over to Vincent. Vincent, here's the scary part. You work on polio, which in itself is scary. You're the first person to create a recombinant synthetic organism. I call it an organism. Maybe you disagree that a virus is an organism per se, but you know, that was your first, you know, giant contribution to the world of virology. But you know, all the movies, right? They're all based on your work, right? All the horror movies. So maybe what was your first day? Was it as bad as the Dustin Hoffman film?
If I had a bad day like that, I wouldn't tell you, because it just gives fuel to the people who say that these kinds of experiments should be restricted. I've been recently involved in quite a few dialogues about this, and there's this perception that scientists handling dangerous infectious agents, for example, can't be trusted to do the work without huge containment because they make mistakes all the time. When in reality, the fact is that we do pretty well. And I cannot think of a really bad incident involving viruses that I could tell you about, which would be interesting. And that's because we're careful. But what I would like to talk about is something that happened when I was a student, a PhD student, and involves radioactivity. Back then, we used to grow up preparations of influenza viruses. And these are viruses where the nucleic acid is RNA. And we wanted to isotopically label the nucleic acid with phosphorus, a radioactive isotope of phosphorus. We would use P32, which we would buy commercially. We would actually buy P32 labeled orthophosphate, and we would put that in the medium of the infected cells. The virus would then incorporate the radioactive phosphorus into its nucleic acid, and then it was labeled, and you could do your experiment with it. Now, we had a standing order of 50 millicuries per week of P32 in the laboratory. And today, that's a lot, because nowadays we use microcurie amounts. So it was quite a bit. And every experiment, we would use millicuries of P32. Now, P32 you can detect with a Geiger counter. And in those days, I used to go around with a Geiger counter and check things, because if people get sloppy, then you get P32 everywhere, and you can pick it up pretty easily. So one day, I'm walking around with a Geiger counter, and one of the doorknobs is hot. Quite a bit of P32 on it. Then I go to the phone, and the phone is hot too. All the doorknobs turned out to be hot. All the common things in the laboratory turn out to be contaminated with P32. So finally, I got an idea. I went into the men's bathroom, and I checked the urinals, and they were hot too.
Oh, no.
So whoever was spreading the P32 around had it absorbed it to the point where he was now urinating it out. And, you know, I went to the men's room because that's where I was allowed to go. If I were equal opportunity, I would have checked both, but I couldn't. So eventually what happened is we did a lot of talking to people, and one of the individuals who was visiting from the Soviet Union, what he would do, he would take his tube of radioactively labeled virus. So let's say this is one of those. This is not the exact thing. He'd pull this out of a centrifuge rotor, and it had liquid on the outside because it had spilled a little. So he would take the tube and grip it like this and wipe the liquid off. And so his hands were totally saturated with P32, and then he'd spread it everywhere in the lab. So that's about the worst day I can think of in my laboratory.
You know, one of the you're very right about how in the field of virology, one can, you know, there's ways and protocols to manage containment and so forth. And if it wasn't for your work, you know, in virology, there wouldn't be vaccines, right? And vaccines, by saving hundreds of millions of people, can from death or very discomforting diseases, is probably the largest contribution somebody can make, other than, you know, a peace treaty. I mean, it's that big a social effect, right? So it's huge. So continue on your work, and many more days in the lab. And so, you know, that being said, nobody should be afraid of some of the virology that that's out there. You know, Peter Pelese brought back the virus that caused the 50 million people to die in September, through, sorry, was it October through February in 1918. And, you know, the virus, we have a herd immunity. But that being said, it led to an understanding of why that virus was as pathogenic as it was. And that helps us understand influenza, and I mean, it's tremendously good work. Why don't we go to Dave Brodbeck?
Okay, well, I mean, there's a couple I can think of as far as worst days, but we didn't use a lot of big gear because we were doing basically observational stuff with animals. And so I haven't really wrecked anything. I went a couple of times, birds got loose, but that's not interesting. The best one I can think of for the worst day is I was in a class with a buddy of mine who's now a neuroscience prof down at Emory, and let's name him. His name's Rob. His initials are Rob Hampton. And Rob and I were in a class with our PhD supervisor and one other person, so we kind of really had to participate. And we basically had to read a bunch of papers every week, like we'll do. And we ended up going to I said, let's go to Rob's tonight. We'll read papers. And on the way home, we stopped at the beer store and bought a case of beer. And we sat down at my place, and we proceeded to drink 24 of beer. And we didn't read the articles, of course. So the next day, we're having this paper, this thing, we're discussing this paper with our supervisor and one other student, and he's a guy from Iceland who never said a word. So it was really on us. And our supervisor, Sarah Shuttleworth, she looked over and, you know, said, what did you guys think of this paper? And my friend Ross started speaking in broad generalities about methods. So he's just saying, well, when you look at the number of subjects in that group, like really, you know. And she kept looking at him. But what did you think of the, you know, the design? What did you think of the results? And I looked over at her and I said, Sarah, we didn't read. We got drunk last night. And my buddy Rob, his eyes got big, like the size of like the moon. He said, what are you doing? I said, whisper. She's right beside us. I said, she can hear us. She's going to regret that we didn't read the article, man. And I said, we didn't read it. We're sorry. And, you know, there's no reason to lie to you. And you've already caught us anyway. And she closed up her stuff, walked out of the room and said, okay, class is over. Because that was it. Because the guy from Iceland was never going to say a word. And for 2 weeks, she did not say a word to us. We'd walk by her like lab. We'd walk by her office. She'd look at us, look through us. Eventually, she forgave us, of course. And in fact, I told this story just 3 weeks ago when she won the Donald Hebb Award for outstanding contribution to experimental psychology in Canada in a career, and forgotten it completely. You know, rose-colored glasses and all. But that was probably the most frightening day of my life. And I just figured I've got to tell her that we didn't do the reading. And let's make it, let's, you know, and we also had hangovers, right? So it's like, you know, I'm sorry. We didn't do the reading, and we got really hammered last night. So that was probably my worst day.
That's pretty good. Let's go to George Farr. Let's go to George. That one will be hard to top, though. Although it was Canadian beer, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. All right. Go ahead, George.
I think most of these stories are pretty hard to top. I must admit, I'm probably inclined to go the same way that Dave Thomas went, which is, you know, I mean, every day's a good day. I mean, there's always positive, great things happening, and I'm always eager to get into the lab to do what I love to do the most. But if I had to think of the worst day in the lab that I ever had, it probably would be when I was a graduate student. So I think I was in my second or my third year. So I really got to the point where, you know, you really have things up and running. You're in a good groove. You're cranking out the data. You're sorting things out, you know, really kicking along just great. And the experiments that I was doing, I was using radioactive methionine. So it's 35S labeled methionine to synthesize proteins in vitro in a reticulocyte lysate. And my scientific career depended upon, you know, having this radioactive amino acid and being able to do these syntheses every single day. And I come in one morning
And the radiation safety people are in the lab telling us all that we're not allowed to do any more work. And I said, well, why? What did we do wrong? What happened? Well, apparently, over the weekend, it was discovered by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that somebody in a lab at the hospital, it was right around Halloween, had some kids come into the lab, and they were giving the kids candy in the lab because it was Halloween. Well, of course, this is a big no-no. You know, first of all, you're not allowed to have the kids in the lab. Second, you shouldn't be giving anybody any kind of food or certainly not candy in the lab. And so what happened, and it was a lab at the hospital that used radioactive materials as well. And what happened was that somebody called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and complained about it. And so then what happened was the NRC, of course, going through the motions, they called.
Not my first. NRC.
Oh, okay. not his, not Andre's. So they called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, complained. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission called the university and said, we've had a complaint. We need to talk to your radiation safety officer, the RSO for the university. And the response was, well, Dr. So-and-so, he's not around. Well, where is he? Well, he passed away 2 years ago. So this university was operating without a radiation safety officer for a couple That's of awesome. Years. And there was no acting radiation safety officer. So the NRC basically said, okay, that's it. We are shutting down the university for 6 months. And you guys are all going to have to be completely recommissioned. So there it was, 6 months of my graduate career put on hold because somebody was goofing around in the lab.
The video's frozen, but my jaw is on the floor. It's just shocking.
Wow. Well, we're going to get to the best days. We have just two more really stories of lab horror. That's pretty bad. I mean, God. Yeah.
Don't worry. I found other things to do.
Here's my number one safety protocol for our lab. It's that all beverages have to be on the top shelf so nothing can drip into them. Right? So, well, this is a private company. We can do
that. Yeah. We actually, make sure the polonium is down below, right?
Right. Yeah, those...
is there a mic on?
So, we've got Justin Sanchez as well, who does brain-machine interfaces. Why don't you explain, which is, in fact, very exciting, but can also be very scary, because you're working with human patients, aren't you?
Yeah, sure are. So you want a bad day or a good day?
Bad day. Then I'll tell my bad. I've got three bad days, and all of them were in the Dave Thomas lab.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I have a particular bad day, but, you know, one thing that came to mind after hearing all the funny stories here is that, you know, a lot of people or students, you know, they come into the lab and they're like, you know, where does scientific inspiration come from? And, you know, in a lot of ways, some of the greatest discoveries come from the worst days in the lab, right? When something goes terribly wrong or goes, you know, a way that you didn't expect, it really forces you to kind of get out of your comfort zone and think about things in a real different way. So, you know, just like Dave Thomas was saying that, you know, I don't think that there is any bad day in the lab. I really agree with that, because whenever something really does go wrong, you know, more often than not, we find, you know, very innovative and interesting new ways to kind of work around those kinds of things. So I think those are great situations.
Hey, so I'm going to my PhD mentor's in the Skype call here and then on the show. So I have to be very cautious of how I present my best and worst days of the lab. And so I've got a couple of little scenarios that were very, traumatizing, I suppose. And the first one is that when I had applied to McGill to do a PhD, one, I hadn't completed my master's, and it didn't seem to matter to McGill that I hadn't completed my master's. So I had to, while I was doing my PhD during the day, do my master's at night and write up that thesis. But I had 6 months to complete it. So there was a little flexibility there, which was I really appreciated. But so Dave, I was accepted to interview and find a professor at McGill. And Dave was off campus. He was at the Biotechnology Research Institute, which I thought was not only cool. He had a great lab doing a lot of great yeast genetics, and having done a master's in plant genetics, you always want to go to a simpler, more powerful system. And no one in Canada was doing it better than Dave. So I thought this was really great. What a great opportunity to go do a PhD at McGill working for Dave Thomas. So I was very, very excited about it. And then I meet with Reg Storms. Dave knows Reg Storms. He was a professor, and I think he's still a professor at the biology department at Concordia, where I was doing my master's. He said, why don't you come over and we'll do a mock interview? So we sit there. I join him in his office. He says, why would you like to do a PhD in this lab? And I give him these answers that I thought were appropriate, and explain my interest in complex genetic traits, and I think that yeast is a better system to do so. Plants, you can do one at a time, but every 3 months you have a new organism. It's just not the best way to map out complex biological processes and complex genetic traits. And at the end of the interview, he looks at me and says, well, at least you should go there for the experience. Like, damn. Oh, man. Right. So I had no chance in hell of getting to Dave's lab, which I thought was going to be the best thing that I could do. But then again, I went
really
and
interested in complex traits now. And we're developing a project around modified genes for cystic fibrosis trafficking. Yeah. Anyway, you're way ahead of your time.
There you go. There you go. Thank you, Dave. That's very kind. The interview went well. I mean, I was fascinated by what you were presenting on the CF side and the protein trafficking. What I really appreciated was the fundamental biological process that you were studying, and that was the quality control of how proteins fold in the cell, secretory proteins and membrane proteins. I thought that if you could answer fundamental questions, it would be a really interesting scientific project. And I met with Malcolm Whiteway, who's been on the show as well. And he was, a very enthusiastic scientist, one of the most enthusiastic people that I'd ever met. So, and he was a geneticist, making a living doing genetics. And I thought it was just very keen. So that was not the worst day in my life, worst day in the lab, sorry. I think one of the projects, we were studying protein trafficking, right? How a protein, when it's synthesized, is built in the cell and released to the surface and released into the environment or to the cellular environment. And we were studying alpha-1 antitrypsin. And alpha-1 antitrypsin there's a mutation where the defective alpha-1 antitrypsin, and this affects tens of thousands of people because the protein's made in the liver and it has to traffic to the lungs. And so it's a blood protein. So we were using a yeast system called Schizosaccharomyces pombi. And yeast is great because it's genetically tractable. But Cerevisiae, the beer yeast or baker's yeast, brewer's yeast, doesn't have the quality control apparatus that human cells have in its ability to make proteins. But pombi does. So we spent about 2 years trying to... Well, there was a learning curve. Of course, every PhD student has a two-year learning curve before they can do anything productive. And it took about 2 years to figure out that the plasmid was simply being dropped. So we were making the protein. We thought it was being degraded in the cell, but it was actually just the stability of the plasmid. And this, I finally, after 2 years of having very confusing data, did population genetics. And what we did is something called a yeastern. Grow yeast on a plate, put a membrane, a nitrocellulose membrane, lift the membrane, you put it down on the yeast, let the yeast secrete the protein, you lift the membrane, you do a quick hybridization with an antibody so you can detect the protein. And what I found is that multiple strains would behave one way, multiple strains would behave the other way, and the protein was actually not being secreted. And if you picked the wrong strain and followed that strain throughout, you were not actually studying an ER-associated protein degradation, a very complex quality control mechanism. You're just studying poor Pombi genetics. And Pombi, while it had this complex system, like a human cell, was just not as genetically tractable as possible. as we're hoping. That being said, I go into Dave's lab after 2 years. Dave looks at me and says, "All right, what's next?" I just spent 2 years just struggling and every waking hour I could in the lab. And Dave, you know, what's next? And he also said, "Well, you don't have any gray hair, so you got plenty of time to get this right." which was a fun story. And it taught me, one, don't be afraid of taking on big projects. Two, even after 2 years, if they fail, you can still go on to tackle interesting projects that are risky. And three, do a plan B project that'll get you some success and keep the grants flowing and keep your science running. But always do that crazy experiment that nobody else can do. So, yeah, I guess that was my worst days, is trying to, after 2 years, you know, just stepping away from the project and going on to something else. Is that a good recollection of what happened, Dave? Or is this my...
Hey, Mark, I don't remember it at all, except I think we just met it for a couple of weeks. Yeah, but I do want to point out that one thing you initiated, which was the ER2 hybrid, we just published a huge interaction map of all the chaperones in the ER. And that stuff that you developed there, that was pretty exciting. You should have concentrated on that a little bit more. I don't remember it taking 2 years, but no, who knows?
That was a Dave Thomas idea. So one of the difficulties is studying protein attractions in the cell. And in subcellular compartments, it's really tough to monitor those protein interactions. Dave came up with a really good idea. He said, "Why don't you try this?" And we were able to detect protein interactions in the compartment where secretory proteins are made, where this alpha 1 antitrypsin is made. Not to get into too much detail, but it was fun. And that was my, you know, you encouraged entrepreneurship, and that, because that was a potential business as well. So that was a good day in the lab. I'm glad it's working, and I'm glad it's continued.
Can I just step in? So I just have to say, this is a sign of great mentoring from Dave for you, because if you would have been in a different lab with a different type of mentor who would have just been angry and thrown books or done whatever, you wouldn't be a scientist today, and you wouldn't have us sitting here in this office, and you probably wouldn't be doing this show anymore. So I think that's a great answer to a 2 year failure. Is okay. What's next?
Roll with the punches, kid.
This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. Have a little bit of fear in you, just a little bit.
One thing about
you think you're going to kill them, but then you pleasantly surprise them. Right.
I was lucky to have Andre Nantel on the bench right beside me, which was very, very handy, and because he must have answered 200,000 questions.
Not to mention stealing a number of pipette boxes.
Did I steal your pipette boxes? I stole mine. We had to tip them by hand in the Dave Thomas lab, but it was a very, very good experience. And I think at one point I went 6 months without talking to Dave, which was a really good way to learn to be independent, right? Without a mentor and how to design your own project. So that was a good thing, Dave. Why don't we talk about the best day? Okay, so let's we've got eight people and they're being awfully good and quiet.
All right, I'll go. Since I don't have bad days in the lab, and this is why, best day for me is real easy. March 13th, 2012. And it did not happen in the lab. I was actually working a full-time job, working for Mark part-time since August of 2010. And I was at work that day and ended up, Mark calls me up at about 3:30 in the afternoon. I'm about to go home for the day. He calls me up and says, "Hey, by the way, we're going to need you full time." He goes, I'll give you some time to think about it. And my first reaction to him was, "Mark, I've been thinking about this since August of 2010. I've made my decision. let me hang up so I can go tell my supervisor that I'm putting in my notice. I worked one more day, went out of town for the weekend, and started on Monday working for Mark full time. Best day ever.
You know, I think one of the things about what we do in entrepreneurial biotech, right, when you start a company and you try to translate what's going on in the universities and develop it, one of the difficult things is creating new jobs, new organizational framework where you can bring people on to work. And that's, you're creating a new position. And everyone at Aromics basically created a new position. So Jason, by working part-time after work, analyzing our data. So he was the magic in the box, right? So we put all the raw data into a Dropbox at the end of the day. And the next morning we come back and poof, it's analyzed.
Yeah,
it was three hours a night. You did 2 or 3 hours a night for 2 years or 3 years after a full-time job.
And, so Jason, how do you feel about night work on a bunch of our data?
Make some money.
We'll talk. You know, look, how much you pay
people to talk to your people? And
all right, here's what you could do: pay him in U.S. dollars on a U.S. tax rate, and then you might have a deal.
A Canadian dollar is at par, I think. Now, right? Am I right? Yeah.
Sort of. Yeah. That's cool. I don't know. Let's go around the table. Who has a great story, a good day?
I can tell one.
Go for it, George.
Okay. So, again, I was a graduate student. End of a long day. And I had some media to autoclave. And I'm at the autoclave, open it up. You know, it's this big sort of metal machine that you put things into to sterilize. So I put my load into the autoclave, and I hear this voice behind me says, "Hey, George." I immediately recognize the voice. I know who this person is that's talking to me. I can't see them because my head's inside the autoclave. This person says, "Hey, George, would you like to go out sometime?" Knowing who it was, I pop my head up, bang the top of my head on the inside of the autoclave, recover myself. I know it sounds like it's the worst day in the lab, but it's not. Come out of the autoclave, and here it is, my future wife asking me out on a date.
In the
lab. Best day in the lab. So that was for my wife, Sue, and I mean it. It was definitely the best day ever in the lab.
I can tell sappy stories, so good at that. No, but seriously, so I've had a good bit of students come through, and there, I can think back to a couple of them in particular where you're in their defense, and one in particular had been a really problematic student, really to the point where we had written him an official letter basically saying if you don't get better in 3 months for disciplinary things, like for really interacting with his lab mates kind of thing, if you don't get better in 3 months, you're gone. And the guy turned it around, and I remember in his defense, he was just nailing it. And I decided I'm going to ask him the hardest question that I can. And I had spent probably 10 minutes thinking about how to phrase it in a way that he wouldn't be able to answer it. The point was just to make it so that he would really struggle. And the guy paused for about 30 seconds and answered the question perfectly. And I still remember just thinking, wow, the guy actually did it. He actually came around, and he deserves his PhD now. And he's at the University of Pennsylvania now doing phenomenally well. And this is a guy who I would have thrown out of my lab.
Wow.
And turned it around.
It just goes to show you, huh?
Yeah.
That, you know, you can't give up on people sometimes.
Yeah, and he worked his ass off. He did work his ass off and worked to make things right with his colleagues. And
so did he meet the ultimatum?
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah. I think he did. He came from a particularly challenging background, and I think he needed to get smacked around into reality. But he's just done phenomenally well. Phenomenally well. He turned into the go-to guy. Growth.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sappy, but I mean, that's why I do what I do. I mean, yeah, right, it's fantastic.
I'll give one because we'll stay in the same room here on the same video line. I have two major here's a sappy one for the audience. One, starting the company was an important element for me to approach science in a new way and in a very in a way that's I think is pragmatic in easy way to see how you can help save lives. So that's is fairly sappy because if you get a drug to market, you potentially can save a million lives a year, and that's where we're at. And so starting the company was a good day when we got our first funding. But two was hiring George, best pair of hands at Yale. And that was a 16-year career with Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and convincing him to move from New Haven, leave Yale, and come to Cleveland. There is a trick, though. He's from Cleveland. So
so it was a great day for me, too.
Yeah. Well, I told him I'd match our salaries for whatever I make in this company he'll make, and that sort of helped maybe a little bit. So my best day in the lab, right, was here we were. It was just myself. The company was me. We're over at my business partner was not a full-time employee. He was a professor at Yale, and he wanted to move to Cleveland. So he had already moved to Cleveland. So my little company was one bench in a lab that was subleased, and I was developing the screening technology and getting the screens going to find a drug that may block these water channels. And
should I look at the camera? Is that it?
Okay, so yeah. I'm talking to them. I'm talking to my group. So if you could block the water channels in the brain, you could basically prevent brain swelling from brain trauma, from stroke, from acute mountain sickness, from meningitis, from glioma, from all these conditions. And there is no drug out there. A fellow named Verkman had published a paper saying that there's no possible way to block these molecular water channels. No drugs work. He probably screened a 500,000 drugs at least by then. This was a Nobel Prize winning discovery that this water channel existed and it controlled the physiology of water in the human body. And we were working on the one that was particular to the brain. And but the company... My business partner had moved to Cleveland. I had put up my house for sale, and I had literally 3 or 4 months because the screening center was in New Haven. It was a Yale screening center, and there's no screening center in Cleveland. So I had to develop the screen in New Haven, get it to work, and then identify some compounds. And by the way, I had two little kids in the house, so getting no sleep, two babies. And at one point I put my glasses down at the beach, that we went to on like a Saturday, put my glasses back on. They were covered with urushiol, which is the poison from poison ivy. And so my eyes were completely covered with blisters. And I thought to myself at the time, cause it was the Bush administration and there was talk about torture is water, boarding torture. I was thinking, you know, what's torture? Poison ivy in the eyes, right? Yeah, and still having to get the work done. So it was a difficult situation. The company had to move very little money, and the whole scenario was a complex, difficult scenario to do. But we did the screen on 20,000 compounds, three of which were of one particular chemical series, which ended up being the drug that's now that we're moving forward. It's in that chemical series. So I managed to identify a new class of drug on a new target that eventually could potentially save some lives.
Mark, I guess you would say it was a blind screen.
It was a blind screen. Yeah. Did blind tests with no control. Actually, we did controls, but it took 2.5 to 3 years of work to demonstrate that this series actually was working. The screen was a very simple test, and we needed to validate it. And that took 2.5 years and a lot of hard work. And George has taken on that side of the lab now and gotten the beautiful pharmacology to work. So thank God we were able to coin that together. So that was my best day, even though I was what felt like torture. And I didn't take the prednisone because I was on Coumadin and I worried about interactions. Yeah. Anyhow. But ended up coming up with a new drug that could potentially save a million lives. And hopefully we'll be through the clinic within the next 18 months. If there's any investors out there, give me a call or tweet me at Mark Peltier. we're looking for investors right now. We have some people lined up and so forth.
Mark, I wanted to just point out to the you guys, since you have a Bruins sweater up there, hockey injuries and football injuries are also... are going to benefit from your discoveries.
So, knock on wood. Yeah. Yeah. Football, you know, one thinks that football is like, and hockey for sure, but there's about 40 Canadians that play hockey. Football is an obvious one, but it's cycling that has the most head trauma out of all the sports because everybody cycles. And little kids come in with head traumas into the hospitals and the brain swells. And all you can do is remove a piece of the skull, right? Or a drill. You can drill them in the head. So it's what George calls Civil War battlefield medicine. So that was my best day. Why don't we leave and go? Let's go to New York City, Vincent. Why don't you?
I've had a number of really good students who have had great results, and I should probably tell you one of those, but I'm going to tell you one of mine because I know it really, really intimately, and I can tell you how it went. This is when I was a postdoc with David Baltimore. This is 1979-ish, and what we were trying to do was take the genetic information of poliovirus and convert it to DNA. So this virus has an RNA genome, as we call it. And this was the first days of recombinant DNA. People were just learning how to take RNA molecules and put them in plasmids and grow them up in bacteria, the forerunner of biotechnology, as you guys know it. So we wanted to take the whole genetic information of the virus, make a DNA copy, and then see if we could recover virus from that. Today, you would call it synthetic biology, but back then, we were just trying to make a DNA copy infectious. So I spent about 2 years assembling a DNA copy of this virus in plasmids. It was really hard because you couldn't buy anything. You had to make everything up from scratch. And there weren't many people around who knew how to do this. But finally, I had assembled this whole copy of the viral genome, which was 7,440 nucleotides long in a plasmid, and I grew it up in bacteria. And then I took this plasmid and I went to my boss, David Baltimore. I said, okay, what do we do next? And he said, just put it in cells. You don't have to do anything else. Just see if it works. Because we were imagining doing all kinds of complicated things with it next. But he said, just put it in cells. And he went off to a meeting in Europe. And he said, if you get a result, let me know. So I did the experiment. And the way we measure, we put the DNA into cells. And the way we measure whether it was infectious or not was to take the medium from the cells and do what we call a plaque assay. So you determine if there's any infectious virus that will form little holes in a cell monolayer. And the way you stain this plaque assay is you stain the cells with a purple dye. So I had done my experiment, I had stained them, and I was washing the plates back and forth. And when you tilt them, the dye moves away and you can see the cells. And I tilted them and I could see plaques on the cells. And I said, holy crap, I have plaques here. And I had to tell someone. So I ran down the hallway to one of the other professors and I showed him. And he said, Vinny, it looks good, but don't tell David. He'll just tell everyone and you have to verify it before you do that. So just seeing those holes on the monolayer sent chills up and down my spine because it was something really cool. And I had done this, and it had taken a long time, and it had worked out. So that was my eureka moment at the very beginning of my career. It was a lot of fun.
That had a lot of implications, right? First synthetic organism, first the potential of creating a new vector for gene therapy. You know, there's just an unbelievable amount of excitement on that project. That's very, very cool. We're going to, Andre Nantel and Dave Broadbeck have to leave at 7, our time. So why don't we go to Andre first, and then we'll go to Dave Broadbeck, and then we'll continue the show. So Andre, why don't you tell us, what was your best moment in the lab?
Well, both stories are definitely not going to be very long. They're mostly moment where I felt the most happy to be a scientist is very often when you get recognition from your peers is always something that's pretty important. And there's like two moments that kind of stand out is like the first time, not the first time I got a CIHR grant, but the first time I got a CIHR grant renewed.
That, for me, the first time it happened, it went like, not only I'm getting a first grant is something, but getting it renewed means like you're doing the right thing. Keep at it. That was tremendously uplifting when that happened to me. And the even earlier moment where I felt the most happiest was the actually still I got about 60 publication. That happened to me only once, where I sent a paper to a major journal and it came back to me not only accepted, but all three reviewers said no modification. So
you'll never get it again.
Yeah, never gonna happen again. But that was really wow. And of course, when that happens, I go like, okay, I should have sent it out to a higher journal. But yeah. I was still pretty happy. I still consider this one of the best publications I ever made.
Yeah, that's cool. You can reject it and send it. But
why don't we take let's go to Dave Broadbeck quickly because he has to leave as well. And Andre, if we don't speak to you, thank you so much for all your work you've done on Futures in Biotech. And hopefully we'll be able to bring you back on Microbe TV. Would that be cool?
It was a pleasure.
Oh, great. You've been a great interviewer as well and guest. By the way, I'd like to mention that Andre Nantel was the first episode of Futures of Biotech. What we did is Leo Laporte's tagline on national radio was anything on a chip. So the first episode was going to be DNA on a chip, tissue on a chip, proteins on a chip. And Andre was very kind enough to participate in that first show. And lo and behold, it didn't go too well. And it wasn't because of Andre, but everybody was talking over each other. It wasn't as smooth as today. And Leo lost the file and the pilot. So I brought back Andre for episode 5 and then profiled him alone. So it allowed us to cover his work more in deeper mode. But so, apologize for losing your file there. And Leo's Mr. Carbonite, right? So it wasn't so much that the file was lost, right? He lost 3 flosses before the first one aired.
Wow.
That's inside, So, but this is before Randall Schwartz. This was when Chris DeBono was the host. So thanks, Andre. I'll let you go. Have a good weekend.
You too, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right. And Dave, you can twist your camera a little bit. Let's go to Dave Broadbeck, and he has to go to at 7 o'clock. So let's squeeze him in. Your best day in the lab.
I think the best day. There's a couple. I think what Andre said, getting a grant. That's the first time that happened. That was pretty blow away because I didn't believe it was going to happen. But I think that the biggest one for me when I had just started my postdoc and I'd gone back to my PhD supervisor's lab to work on a paper together. Everything works better. People do things by email. It's always better to sit down in a room for an hour and a half, hash out some revisions and get it done. And we're sitting there. It was funny because it was the first time in my career that I kind of felt like her equal in a way. Now, I would never say I am her equal scientifically, and she never also made me feel bad. But it was the first time that I felt like I knew something as well as she did. And it was just at that point a statistical thing, and I was always better than her at stats, still am. And she was saying, "No, do it this way," and I said, "No, we don't do it that way. We do it this way." Eventually, I got angry, and I'd never raised my voice to her before, but I had my PhD by then, and I said, "No, we do it like this." And she stopped. She looked at me. She said, "Oh, okay." And then I looked at it. And went, "Actually, you're right." So it turned out, in fact, that for once, she was right on statistics, not me. But the neat thing was, it was the first time that I felt like, and I never, like I said, she never made me feel that I wasn't her equal or anything like that. I felt like she tried to make us all like colleagues, like on day one. I remember reading her NSERC grant proposal when I was two weeks into my master's degree, and I think it was nice font. I mean, I had no idea. But at that point, it was like, I've really graduated. I actually do this as a job now. So that was probably for me personally the best thing. I've had many times when I've seen students go on and do great things and all that stuff. But screw them. That's about them. This is about me.
Cool. Let's go over to so I'll say goodbye to you as well because you're
And I gotta go. And just thanks so much for always having me on, Mark. And I knew that eventually the show would get canceled as soon as Leo tried to get that little kid on here and Ted McGinley took over the show. But anybody get those jokes? Nobody? Anyway.
I got it. I sort of. I'm going to have Jason explain it to me later.
Talk to you guys later, guys.
We're going to keep you on as a subject matter expert on Microbe TV. Anything neurology, so neuroscience. Okay. It'll be great to continue. Let's go to Dave and Dave Thomas in Montreal.
Hi, Mark. Good days in the lab. As I said, every day is a good day. By the way, Vince, I do remember reading that paper and being very impressed on the poliovirus. And I have my own holes in plates stories as well. But I remember when I was a graduate student, I was working on mitochondrial genetics. And just the first joy of getting the first result and being kind of able to explain it. And my supervisor had left the day after I entered graduate school and gone on sabbatical to Australia. And anyway, getting a result, and while my supervisor was away, he had sort of handed me off to his supervisor, who was a very distinguished geneticist working in... at the Imperial Cancer Research Fund in London at that time. And he just looked at my results, and I explained it to him, and he looked at me, and he said, "Do it again." So it went from a kind of a high to a low. Fortunately, a couple of weeks later, I could repeat the result. But, you know, you kind of learn to... get your own pleasure out of research doing these things, you know, and judging your own achievements. Hello.
I guess this is kind of a good point to have on a last episode of a show that's sort of getting retired to sort of go over what we actually do. And this is, you know, it's a very rewarding job and one that is very difficult to leave to do as well. So we're going to continue the podcast on Microbe TV, as we've been mentioning. So one thing I'd like to mention as well, the podcast is probably this podcast, Futures in Biotech. We're going to look at probably a once a month and maybe up to twice a month. But it's very difficult to do because the work in the lab is... or in the company, for example, is very time consuming and risky. So why don't we take it to make predictions? You know, there's in the 80s it was cloning genes. I guess 60s it was discovering structure of a gene. In the 70s it was sort of starting playing with recombinant DNA, getting that to work. The 80s it was sequencing was a big, powerful new tool that allowed us to understand how the primary structure of the protein, all the amino acids that were part of it, and slowly the code of life. The 90s, we started to play with complex genetics and protein interactions and mapping networks and cellular processes, and the human genome was completed in, was it 2098 or 2000? The human genome. Yeah, it was big news at one point. Yeah. So I was too busy in the lab to notice. So then in the 2000s, we were starting to combine major data sets and sort of develop the a translation of the power of the structure of DNA that Watson won the Nobel Prize for. You know, it's starting to come together. And then in this decade, we're at a forefront, right? We've done a lot of the sort of groundwork to change, to make life really a substrate for engineering. But have we reached the 3 megahertz clock speed of our CPU in biotech? Is this the limit? Is this as far as we can go? Are the technologies limited past, or are we going to see, what are we going to see in the next 10 years? And what's this decade going to be in biotech? Let's send it over to Dave Thomas because it's his job to think about these things as a chairman of the committee.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, that's a great job to think about. So I'll give you a couple of things. One, I'm mentoring somebody here that's developing a project, a major project on e-health. And that is sort of apps for your iPhone that will measure your whatever, measure your heart rate, measure your blood pressure, measure your insulin levels, and that will be accessible remotely. So there are a number of devices that you just plug into your iPhone now that are coming online. I think these are going to morph themselves into even greater integration of things, of data, so that you will be almost continuously monitored, so to speak. Your health will be monitored and matched with, let's say, the genes in your genome, your particular polymorphisms, your particular susceptibilities. That's the kind of the grand future. And that will change, I think, the real job of clinicians, of your physicians. Those will be very much more doers rather than people that will actually perform the surgery, say, or other procedures, rather than the kind of family medicine guy you go to see. So the front line will be these apps. That's my prediction. 10 years time, costs won't come down for healthcare, but the integration of technologies will change the job of clinicians, and that there will be a new cadre of bioinformaticians or people that kind of understand the integration of technologies. That's the big, I think, one of the big pictures. And it's going to change a lot of the things we do and a lot of the ways in which healthcare is funded, both in the U.S. under Obamacare or Romneycare or whatever you want to call it, and in other countries too where we already have that sort of socialized system.
I guess basically you're saying that the tricorder will be invented, right? Because that's what it, diagnostics being no longer a doctor's job, but a system of sensors that can detect every biological activity.
Yeah. William Shatner is a McGill graduate and is definitely way ahead of me. He Captain Kirk is leading the way here.
Will this require implanted sensors, or can this be done in some other way without having to be invasive at all?
Yeah, Vince. Yeah, some of it, you know, the haptic things, the things that are going to be thumping your chest or measuring, you know, your muscle tone, will obviously be things that sort of fit on and fit onto your iPhone and kind of hammer parts of your body, or measure parts of your body. Some already there are ways even of measuring cholesterol levels that rely on remote sort of sensing things that you can spread on your hand or whatever. I think those things will start to come in, so that they tend to be less invasive. You don't have to get some blood. But I mean, one of the really interesting papers this year were people making microscopes out of iPhones, and they were purchasing a spherical lens that they were sticking on the camera of the iPhone, and they could actually get pictures of red blood cells. And, you know, if you had sickle cell anemia, you could tell it from normal cells. You know, I mean, that was kind of an amazing paper.
Isn't there a DNA sequencer that's the size of a thumb drive right now? Isn't ion technology, the chip that does the sequencing, literally the size of a thumb drive and powered by USB?
The chip is very small. Yeah, we have one downstairs here, and the chip is certainly very small. For proton torrent, I think the chip, which is the successor to ion torrent, I think the chip is the same chip, in fact, just more features on it. Yeah.
Hey, Mark, could I jump in?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, of course, Dave has one. Go ahead.
I mean, an extension of this is, from my view, what I think is important is to be able to diagnose or detect infections viral, bacterial, whatever, really, really rapidly. So, for example, right now we don't have a lot of antiviral drugs because many of the viral infections are too fast. By the time you diagnose them, it's too late to treat them. Like the common cold is a big one. It's over in a couple of days, but if we could treat it, it would help a lot of people. And to do that, you need near real-time diagnosis. So that's where I see the field going in the next 10 to 20 years. Someone has to develop a way. Maybe it's you take a little nasal wash or spit or even blood from a little puncture of your finger, and then in the next few minutes be able to detect what viruses are present, so then you can get a prescription immediately and treat it. And I think this will have incredible implications for treating infectious diseases.
Why don't we go to Jason? That's
pretty much my. I'm not a biologist. I'm not, you know, I'm an electronics technician by trade and a gadget geek and a computer geek and all that. So basically, I'm going off of what Dave said. Pretty much this whole idea of the technology with the apps and this diagnostics is going to open up a whole other field of security surrounding these apps to prevent people from hijacking your health data, basically. So, I mean, we need this...
Anti-cloning.
Yes.
Right? Somebody could literally create a new you.
Somebody hijacks your fingerprints, your DNA, everything about you, and creates a new you, and...
What if that fan really wants a child from Bieber?
Oh, no.
You can do it. No. You can do it.
They still need the DNA. So. Yeah.
I mean, that's
a good point.
Security
is going to have to be seen from a new way. I think that's a potential next show. We've been interviewing Mark Erstein a number of times on Futures in Biotech. And one of the areas we've talked about a little bit is biological security, like internet security or computer security.
Mm-hmm.
And he was suggesting that, you know, you go to the grocery store, the cart that has your food takes the DNA off your fingers, looks at your profile, and basically, influences your purchases, right? And then, so, mm-hmm. you know, there's a whole lot of information to be gathered from your genome alone, right? Yeah. And so forth.
So, Mark, can you remind us, where are we going to be able to see that show?
On Microbe TV. Microbe.tv. So we're still building that structure right now and working on it. And by the way, these 95 episodes will be archived on Twit TV as a retired
joke. Excellent.
So there's a lot of stuff, a lot of great moments in my life. Okay, wait. So let's go to Griswold, who's an inventor himself. Mark, tell us a little bit about what you see happening in the world of diagnostic tools and.
I think Dave is absolutely right. I think that if you look at where we're going in terms of healthcare, that's what's going to happen. So my son is a type 1 diabetic, and so bio monitoring is a huge part of our life, and it's unbelievable how quickly I can tell you when he's going to be sick the next day. So Vincent, you know, I can tell you from his blood sugar when he's going to get the virus the next day. And so I think that these kinds of things are going to be more and more common. Just to, you know, point everybody towards this. So there's the Qualcomm X challenge, which should be hitting full gear this fall. They're looking at a simple monitor that weighs less than 5 pounds. And I think they're going after the top 15 diseases or something along these lines. And the amazing thing to me is if you go through that list, it shouldn't be that hard. There's really so much basic things that we just don't do very well. And a lot of it is just simply that we don't have access to the healthcare as quickly as we should. So I think that's one big part of it. I think it kind of dovetails into everything else. If we look around, how many of us are exploiting our genetic information to be healthier? No one. How many, you know, or maybe, you know, if you look at the BRCA1, BRCA2
cancer therapies. Other than that, there's just nothing else that's really being used. Very, you know, what proteomic knowledge are we using on a day-to-day basis to make ourselves healthier? Not very much. And so there's just the potential there is just massive to change the way that we take care of ourselves. At some level, that's kind of the basis of all the biotech stuff that we're doing is,
sure,
you know, how can we take care of ourselves better?
So I'm remembering that I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong here, guys, but I'm pretty sure it was Lyndon B. Johnson who declared the war on cancer. And for the
Richard Nixon.
Okay. So Nixon declares the war on cancer in the early 70s, right? And for the first, 20 or 30 years, the progress that was made was primarily early detection. And it's really only more recently now that we're starting to get more new, innovative types of therapies. But that early detection has saved literally millions of lives. And so the notion of having these types of devices and, you know, sort of personal monitoring of what's going on in your body and being able to get some sort of early detection going, you know, especially like Vincent was saying with respect to viruses. I mean, I can't help but think it's key.
You know, I have a different, somewhat of a different take here because I'm in drug development. And, you know, when I hear the term personalized medicine, you know, the term generally refers to having your genome sequenced, your proteome done. You can listen to episode 93 of Futures of Biotech with Mike Snyder, who is the first true case of personalized medicine where he did his genome 70 times over. He did his proteome. He did his transcriptome, the genes that are turned on, the genes that are turned off, looking at 20,000 genes. This was over, 14 months? Through health and disease, he did his antibody profile, right? Showed his which antibodies he had made in his that were in his blood. So that's personalized medicine and sort of a diagnostic process. But the way I see personalized medicine in drug discovery is doing what they do on Star Trek. There's a disease that happens. I need 36 hours, and then having a cure. By the way, that's my son laughing, 2-year-old son. I should turn off my phone. All right. What a distraction. What was I saying? No, okay. Personalized medicine.
36 hours. You got a cure. 36
hours to a cure, either a vaccine,
Dr. McCoy,
a drug that blocks the specific activity of a protein, or gene therapy, or creating an antibody that can inactivate a biological process. If you look at multiple sclerosis right now, right, it's an autoimmune disease where there's an antibody that an individual produces, and it's not something you're predisposed to. It's not a genetic disorder per se. It can happen in adults, and all of a sudden they have a new antibody in their bloodstream, and it starts attacking the Schwann cells that form the insulation along nerves, right? And if you could create an anti-antibody, a way to block the interaction of that antibody with the proteins that it's interacting with on the Schwann cells, you could prevent the onset of MS. But the problem is, which antibody is it?
Sure.
And the way I see medicine happening is being able to take somebody's blood, identifying the antibody that's binding to the profiles of proteins that you find in a Schwann cell, because you can put those on a chip, identify which antibody it is, and do a rapid screen of compounds, maybe even low potency, potentially, but that are pre-tested in terms of toxicology, and then come out with a personalized medicine that could save their lives and the decay. This could potentially be done for every disease. Once we understand the safety profiles of enough compounds that cover cover the potential area of chemical space needed to block these biological interactions, we could basically take a drug off the shelf, screen for it, take a disorder, screen for it with the known drugs, known toxicities, and have a pill overnight for whatever disorder it be, being it multiple sclerosis, cystic fibrosis, any kind of major disease. There's other things that we can't fix as well, I mean, that require, you know, disasters. If somebody has an accident, you know, we're always going to need to fix their bones and so forth and put, you know, do healing in that way. But the idea of the concept of a disease still being around in 100 years, if we can shorten the pipeline of drug development to include, you know, a workflow of rapid development. I think it could be a really exciting time. And I don't think personalized medicine necessarily means defining one person's individuality in terms of biology, but coming with drugs that will treat that person in it that have a unique case.
So a personalized cure,
personalized
so to speak.
Cure, right.
Yeah, yeah,
and there's no
sure.
reason that in the next 50 years we can't do so. Right now, if you look at how drugs have been developed in the past, large companies have spent billions of dollars per drug to get a drug to market with hundreds and hundreds of employees all working on the same problem. And right now, George is, you know, with three other people in the lab taking a drug to the point where it shows tremendous promise. And so I think with the advancement of the diagnostics that we have or the tools that we have in the lab, mass spectrometers, MRIs, plate readers, robotics, and the chemistry that's been developed, you know, especially there's some great Russian chemists as well that have produced giant libraries.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Access to enormous amounts of chemistry very quickly is leading to a revolution where a group of five people can potentially save a million lives.
So, Mark, I think it's pretty safe to say that biotech is nowhere near that 3 gigahertz top end clock speed.
Remind me tomorrow.
And I think, you know, just to kind of address that sort of question, you know, I think that biotech, that biomedical sciences in general is really only limited by two things. The capital to get things done, whether it comes from the government or you know, industry or private sources or whatever, and the imagination of people that are doing the work. And, you know, it just, you know, I can remember being a kid reading, you know, Jules Verne and thinking about all these amazing inventions that he talked about and then realizing that most of those inventions were reality in the day that, you know, that I was born. But back when he was imagining them, they were just his imagination. And I think, you know, I think it's really key to have that passion and imagination and creativity coupled with the capital, you know, the know-how to get things done, but also the capital to actually do things. As long as those things keep coming, you know, through our society, I think the sky continues to be the limit for biotechnology in general.
Right.
We'll just keep going.
Well, when you look at how much it costs, well, even our small little group, it's 1/1000th of what a Pfizer would have done to develop this drug. I think you still need a value in the intellectual property that can allow it to warrant the investment that it takes to actually get these to market, right? It there has to be a business model, or else you know, you won't be able to pay your bills as a scientist. You're going to be, you know, as a monk copying Bibles in the 12th century, doing it for yourself so that you can read your own books. And not moving very fast either. It takes a tremendous amount of capital. Certainly not what it did. So maybe getting cheaper and cheaper, we're going to have some open source tools at one point where we won't need to tap into it. At this moment, we need capital. We need investment. So if there's any investors out there, we got a good listenership on Twitter. So plug, two things, plug, microbe.tv, right? Let me just iterate that the concept of personalized medicine and chemical biology that I'm iterating here is much of Dave Thomas's focus and sort of inspiration to me. So Dave's built a chemical biology facility at McGill that we were trying to emulate here. So is Dave still there? Did they leave? Dave leave? Do we still have Dave Thomas? Oh, he's still there. Oh, his microphone is off. Dave, your mic is muted.
Mic is off. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, there you go.
I lost
all right.
my technical help there. I mean, lots of people are doing this. They're filling a gap that as big pharmaceutical companies move out of the gap, we're kind of moving in, I guess. It's this was predicted a few years ago by several people that really the chancy bits of biotech are going to be done in academia, the less chancy bits in companies, small companies such as your own, and Big Pharma will become the enablers and the doers and the marketers of that technology. And maybe that's a good model.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one we have to live with at the moment, and I think it certainly makes it exciting. So, anybody who's thinking about George Barr had to leave. Thank you, George.
Thanks, George.
You're welcome. It was great. Take care, guys.
See you Monday.
And I think it's a good model, and it's certainly a fun job to be able to make. Wow, our video is really messed up. Apologize for the technical difficulties here. So why don't I? There's not going to be any editing to our man. I apologize for this. So let's do this. Why don't I thank everybody for being on the show? I'd like to thank Justin Sanchez. Dave Broadbeck, we've got Dave Thomas, McGill, Andre Nautel for being on the show, George Farr, Mark Griswold, Jason Book. I pronounce it Buke. Anyway, that's Canadian pronunciation.
No, he really does know my name.
And I'd like to thank everybody who've been on the show. And before we go, though, I'd like to send it over to Vincent, and perhaps you could explain what your ideas are, your thoughts are for Microbe TV. You had an email that was sent to you. Perhaps you'd like to take a look at it, read it to the audience.
Sure. Let me read the email because it sets up what I'd like to discuss just briefly. This is from it's from Al, who's in Hawaii, and he's writing the email to Dr. Kiki, and he copied it to you, Mark, and me. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Kiki. I really enjoyed your in-depth interviews with active scientist experts in their fields. I feel that your work and Mark Pelletier's interviews are complementary. I learned so much and always felt that it was a great honor to hear what these people took the time to share. Thank you, and thank all of them. I never really thought Twit and Leo were the right fit for science broadcasting, though they do have the podcasting technology and talent to do an amazing job. I'm glad it worked for a while, but I hope these important science shows can continue and flourish in a more science-oriented network environment. I hope you and Mark will both try to continue your shows, perhaps in conjunction with Vincent Racaniello's TWIV network. You are all my heroes, and I think you would all make a great science network together. Vincent and his amazing friends at TWIV, etc., are wonderful and dedicated to science broadcasting, just like you and Mark. Dr. Kiki, I also hope that you will continue the science and laughs with Justin on This Week in Science, which I also listen to along with Diffusion Science Radio from Australia. Both are hugely informative and funny shows. Thank you so much for all you do for science education. It is a very good thing. Sorry for this disruption in your life. I hope it is not too painful. Very, very, very respectfully and with much appreciation, Al." So the idea we had is to put together a network of science podcasts. And it was pushed forward. I've had this idea for a while now, and it was accelerated by Mark leaving the Twit network. So our idea is to build a podcast network, not large on the scale of Twit, but substantially smaller, but one focused on all kinds of science, involving scientists doing podcasts about science. And so that's what we call Microbe TV. And I've given it that name because I didn't want to use TWIV. It's something that I've been doing my whole career. I've been working on microbes, but it won't be limited to just microbes. And hopefully we can get a number of shows going. We have four so far, three of mine and Mark's Futures in Biotech. And if we can get a number of others, perhaps we can get some financial support to do this and do it in a proper way. So that's the idea. And as Mark said, we have a skeletal website, microbe.tv, which we'll keep on working on. And just stay tuned for the future of science podcasting, I think.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, Vincent. I've always admired your initiative in taking something from scratch and building up a network. Your show is tremendous, and there's a great likability of your panelists as well. They're very entertaining. And you've picked great people, so you've always tended to do the right thing. I think it's a great opportunity. When I thought, you know, should we do this together? Would it be, you know, would it, you know, what would it be like? And I think it's going to be very exciting because the audiences are so interrelated. We've got to create a momentum together, I think, to build that community as Leo has always done. And don't forget, Leo did this in one room. When Fib started, it was one room and five podcasts. And at that time, Fib had 70,000 listeners. And all the shows on that network, it was just Leo, had between 50 and 150,000. But that was a wider subject matter. And biotech and virology, for example, is a narrower subject matter. But the idea is to bring those people in to the field and show them what is exciting to us and perhaps create a whole bunch of new scientists. Our video is frozen, so we've been having a little bit of technical video difficulty. I apologize to the video audience that are downloading this. Fortunately, Microbe TV will start off as an audio podcast only for a while until we've worked out the flow workflow to get live streaming and live content. But so I look forward, Vincent, to joining you on Microbe TV. This is going to be a lot of fun. It's always been fun, so let the fun continue.
I agree. I think it's going to be very exciting, and I look forward to it, Mark.
For me, it's been an inspiration to meet the scientists doing the best science in the world and to use their frame of mind, try and ascribe to their frame of mind and discovery and pour it back into my work. Try to think like them. And the only way to think like them is to talk to them. And so I'd really like to thank Leo Laporte, the chief twit of the Twit Network, for making this possible. He's been very supportive, and over 6 years, I've managed to meet really the best scientists in the world. And after 95 episodes and, you know, an hour and a half each, it's been, I can't help but think that I might have learned something. So thank you, Leo, very much for supporting Futures in Biotech and giving us our 6 year start. Because it's just the start, right? You know?
Oh, definitely.
Definitely.
I'd like to just say, I mean, with the advent of the Twit Network and, you know, by extension, Futures in Biotech, it's making the science and the technology accessible to everybody, you know, to anybody that wants to listen to it. So you don't have to be a PhD. You don't have to be, you know, want to go to, you know, go to grad school, get your PhD to learn something about the sciences. And I, you know, Vincent, I'd like to thank you for, you know, wanting to keep this going and keep the science education going for everybody out there.
Well, thank you for listening. That's how. So I walked into the lunchroom here. Jason was between jobs, and that's how we met. And he recognized me from my credit card and the name. So you're on the Twit Network. So yeah, we indeed met because of Leo. So he's our chief data analyst. So this kind of thing worked out very well. I'd also like to thank the crew that, you know, helped get this going. You know, back at the old cottage, Dane Golden came on and really helped propel Futures in Biotech considerably. Colleen for inventing a lot of the technologies that are now used at the Twit Cottage. Eric Lanigan was also an excellent producer for the show. I'd like to thank them and not forget them and their contributions, because they worked for us with us for 3 to 4 years, and it was very, very appreciated. I'd also like to thank more recent folks, Liz, Jeff, Tony, John, Frederic, and the entire crew that have made these last 95 episodes an opportunity of a lifetime. I'd like to also thank Alex. Thank you so much for handling the boards and trying to stay on the bleeding edge here of 8 PhDs and 5 connections and a lot of Skype error. I don't know. Your Skype keeps updating. I think it's it was great. Thank you so much for doing the audio and visual audio and video today.
I apologize for all the technical stuff, whatever happened.
Oh, don't worry about it. This worked out. I think the audio is what counts here. Thanks so much. And so if anybody has any comments or suggestions, you can visit futuresinbiotech.com. There's a link there to contact me, and you can send an email. You can also go visit the new home at microbe.tv, microbe.tv. Or you can send me a message on Twitter at Mark, M-A-R-C, Pelletier, P-E-L-L-E-T-I-E-R, in one word, Mark Pelletier. So for Futures in Biotech, this was Mark Pelletier.